can pick up a sheet of paper on your way out, which has the URL address of the website where you can access those. And the recording and podcasts are being made courtesy of the Center for Creative Communication, Centennial College. So thanks to them. Okay, today, the copyright and clearance licensing creativity session, which, as all the other industry sessions, have been generously supported by the Canadian Television Fund, is in a sense a bit of a follow-up for those of you who might have been to our copyright hell panel 2 years ago. And I don't think I mentioned to some of the panelists that it was actually called copyright hell, so apologies. For those of you who were in attendance then, this can be seen as a discussion of current copyright practices and concerns, as I said, in a bit of a follow-up. Otherwise, it, you know, will promise to be chock full of important information, insight, and advice about Canadian copyright culture, procedure, and tips on how to work with, as well as how to challenge existing copyright laws and limitations. And before I introduce Kevin, I would like to just mention that in the guide, we didn't have a chance to include Dan Henry, Senior Legal Counsel, CBC, and he has joined us today as well, so it's a pleasure to welcome him. And for those of you who haven't checked out the first floor, we have micro meetings taking place through Thursday. And also this afternoon, if you're around, we have our Kickstart panels, which are geared towards emerging filmmakers. And if any of you are interested in those, please come back this afternoon. And with that, I'd just like to welcome Kevin, who will be moderating today's discussion, and enjoy the panel. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jessica. Thank you all, welcome. Thank you for coming. I think I'd like to start by introducing everyone on the panel so that you know who you're looking at. As you know, my name's Kevin McMahon. I'm a filmmaker. I have absolutely no expertise in copyright or clearance or any of it. And I think the only reason I was asked to moderate this panel is because I tend to complain a lot about it, as probably most filmmakers do, both about the hassle of it and the expense of it. So I'm hoping that our panelists today will, if any of you share my complaints, will help us make our process at least more efficient. Just to introduce the panel, directly to my left is Dan Henry. Dan is a, I think I'll read this so I don't make a mistake. Dan's been with the CBC since 1978. And advises the corporation on the legalities around all the programming there. He's reviewed thousands of stories before broadcast and directed the defense of many that were challenged. So welcome, Dan. Thank you for coming. Kerwin Cox, many of you will know, is an established and accomplished filmmaker. He's made many films dealing with a variety of issues, many of them cultural and many of them political. And Kerwin's been very involved with DOC, the Documentary Organization of Canada, and particularly has been very involved in the issue of copyright. Beside Kerwin is Steve Beattie. Steve is has been an insurance broker for 20 years, working, I guess, primarily in media. He's with Creighton and Company and is a vice president of the company. The far end there is Howard Knopf, who many of you will know. Howard was here a couple of years ago when Hot Docs dealt with this issue. Howard is a practicing lawyer and is chairman of the Copyright Policy Committee of the Canadian Bar Association, and an advisor to the Law Commission of Canada on copyright issues, and has a great blog called Excessive Copyright, which makes for really entertaining and sometimes frustrating reading. Not because the writing's not great, but because the situation's frustrating. I think it's a huge area, and there's many things to deal with. And I think that what we'll try to focus on today is what the situation is now for practicing filmmakers in terms of copyright and clearance. Although I know that some of you may or may not know that copyright law is under review in Canada and I think in other places as well. And the Documentary Organization of Canada is quite involved in trying to influence the law in this country. And there's a whole movement in the United States of documentary makers who are, I don't know so much about trying to influence the law, but certainly trying to influence practice down there. I think what we want to, as I say, try and get at is, what's the situation now, and particularly in terms of day-to-day operations, in terms of what you can essentially get away with in filming, and in terms of fair use of material that you may want to quote. So I think I'd like to start with Kerwin, because Kerwin has looked at this extensively from a filmmaker's point of view. I think I would start by saying, or asking, in your mind, Kerwin, from your point of view and in terms of the work you've done with Doc, what's the complaint you hear most often from filmmakers about the copyright clearance situation?
I would say that it's just extremely vague. No one knows, you know, whether they're breaking the law or not breaking the law. So they hire a lawyer, tell them, and the lawyer says, is very conservative and says, you can't do this, you can't do that. Then the insurance companies are on top of that saying, right, you've got to be very careful. And so it tends that the copyright law as it's now being applied appears to be a kind of censorship on content because no one's quite sure what to do, and so everyone errs on the side of conservatism. And because, as you said, the Copyright Act is under review and is supposed to be changed soon, Doc got involved in trying to figure out what its position should be with the help of the University of Ottawa, David Pugh there. And so we did a survey. We contacted our members and asked them a whole bunch of questions about copyright. And I had no idea what the results would be because filmmakers are on both sides of the coin. On the one hand, they want copyright to protect their work and, you know, get money in the future. On the other hand, they have to deal with copyright in order to make the film. And it therefore came as a great surprise to me when I found out that 85% of the people who responded to the survey said that copyright was just a pain in the ass, it did more harm than good, and they didn't like it at all, it wasn't good for them. And that also 27% of their budget on average goes to paying for copyright, paying for releases and clearances and so forth, and that this is a huge amount. The other thing to consider, and something I've come to understand, is that the copyright needs of fiction filmmakers and the copyright needs of nonfiction filmmakers are entirely different. And they live in entirely different worlds from a copyright point of view. A nonfiction filmmaker needs reality to make what they're doing. A fiction filmmaker can ignore reality, and they can hire somebody to write the music, they can hire somebody to write the words that people say, they can hire the people to say the words, etc. And so they make an entirely artificial construct. And then, of course, they own the rights to all of that because they've paid all these people. And therefore, they want the copyright to go on for 1,000 years, maybe longer. And they want it, you know, to get maximum dollars. And that's the only thing that they want, is to get more and more money out of that work once it's been made. In the case of nonfiction filmmakers, they go down the street and they're shooting something because, you know, that's what they're making the film about, and they're shooting Sony signs or they're shooting something else, and Sony is going to say, some lawyer will say, wait a second, you have clearance from Sony because Sony is in that shot. And the answer is, are you kidding? Sony wants to be in the shot. No, you've got to have clearance or else God knows, Sony will sue us. They'll rip you apart. If you want to make an historical documentary, you're in deep shit, right? Because then you can't go back and redo World War II as much as you might want to, and so you've got to go and use the footage that's available. And the footage that's available is now owned by massive conglomerates who've decided that that old footage is their profit center. And they're going to get as much as they can out of you if you want to use that footage. They're not going to sell it to you in perpetuity anymore. They're going to sell it to you for maybe 3 weeks, and then you have to renew it. And even the National Film Board can no longer afford to keep its films in distribution because it can't afford to buy the rights at the beginning when they make films. So after 10 years or 15 years, which tends to go by very quickly if you get to be as old as I am, then all of a sudden it's gone. And they had a film like the film about Billy Bishop, the kid who couldn't shoot straight. and sorry, the kid who couldn't miss, I'm confused with the mafia. And the kid that couldn't miss got into a lot of trouble for political reasons because the film board was saying that Billy Bishop, War Hero, had lied. But then on the other hand, after 15 years, rights lapsed, and so the film was withdrawn. An extremely good film, very important Canadian film, produced by the National Film Board. If the National Film Board can't afford to keep films in distribution because of copyright lapsing, then, you know, what independent producer can afford to do that? So there's that kind of problem going on. So there's an entire clearance culture of insurers and of lawyers that make it hard to make documentaries. They either make it hard to make documentaries because of the cost. If you want the archival footage, you're going to have problems because of the fact that you can't get stuff in perpetuity, so that'll be a problem. Because of the fact that an awful lot of people say, wait a second, you're making a movie? Yeah, I heard about you, you know, Hollywood. You know, I want a lot of money now. And so there's that kind of a problem as well. So basically, documentary filmmakers have a huge problem with copyright. And in the survey, it became quite clear. And they just want the laws changed. Also, another problem is fair dealing. Fair dealing in Canada is that idea that you can use a little piece of something, and because you might want to comment critically on it. Like say you wanted to use Steamboat Willie, a 1928 Mickey Mouse cartoon, something as a matter of fact I used in a film once. And so you contact Disney, as I did, with one hand over an eye saying, okay, how much? And Disney doesn't answer. They say, are you kidding? You know, Steamboat Willie, Mickey Mouse, you want to use Mickey Mouse? We're not even going to talk to you. And so there I was needing to use it because something historically happened with that animation cartoon. It was being run on BBC in 1939 when World War II started. And so the BBC cut off their experimental TV transmitter halfway through Steamboat Willie. In 1945, they decided to restart their television system with the other half of Steamboat Willie, sort of like, there's Steamboat Willie, and by the way, something happened in the middle. So I couldn't use something else. I had to use that for historically accurate reasons. Disney wouldn't talk to me. So I said, okay, I'm going to just use Steamboat Willie anyway. And I used 15 seconds and 39, 15 seconds and 45, and I prayed to God that 30 seconds was fair dealing, fair use. And so I did that. And the program ran on CBC. And CBC, I don't think, knew the details of this little thing. And in the middle of World War II, there was a space for the commercials. And so I'm watching it on television, and I'm, you know, sweating bullets. And then the commercial break comes on, and who bought the commercial? Disney. And Disney said, okay, come down to Orlando or somewhere for something. And then back on Steamboat Willie. And I think, oh my God, they must have had somebody checking their commercials, right, to be sure they're well placed. They would have seen Steamboat Willie. I'm dead, you know, I'm finished. Because even if I'm right about the fair dealing, you know, how much is it going to cost to defend? I never heard from Disney. They were so anxious not to talk to me to begin with, they didn't even want to talk to me to sue me. And so therefore, Steamboat Willie went ahead. I don't recommend doing this. But the problem is that in fair dealing, there is no jurisprudence that makes it quite clear whether my 30-second rule was correct or whether I had to do it on some other basis. I also, of course, said the classic documentary, Steamboat Willie. By using the word classic, I made a critical comment, and I was positive that would work in court. But luckily, we don't know. Okay, so I think that after we found out that documentary filmmakers have trouble with copyright, the next thing we did was we worked with Howard Knopp on developing a white paper for the purposes of influencing the government as they changed copyright legislation. We then also wrote a letter to the ministers, Oda and Bernier, based on the results of the white paper, signed by about 140 people, Denny Arcand, all kinds of people signed it, saying that the copyright legislation has to be changed. We then decided to look at the insurance question, and we did a survey of DOC members, and 170 responded on insurance. And what they said was that they spent last year $5 million on production and E&O insurance, and they said for the past 5 years they've never had a claim in E&O, not one. 170 people over 5 years, not one E&O claim. Some people wrote nasty letters, but nothing went to court. And so consequently, documentary filmmakers are paying massively for a relatively low risk. And so there's a disconnect there. And the insurance industry, I'd be interested in any statistics they have about what the real risk is. And you should know that E&O is not used in Europe or anywhere in the world that I'm aware of except North America. And so it's really us that are doing it because the U.S. is the land of the litigious and the home of the E&O.
So,
okay.
Sure.
The only other thing I wanted to mention is that in the United States, the documentary filmmakers have gotten together through the American University, Pat Ofterhide and Peter Jazzy, in order to put together a pamphlet of best practices for fair use, which is the equivalent of fair dealing, to define it. And now some of the American insurance companies are saying to the filmmakers, if you follow that best practices, we will lower our E&O rates or we will accept it. And so that's what Doc is going to try and do up here, do something similar. That's it.
I don't know how you got away with the Steamboat Willie thing, because
no one knew. That's the only way I
but
got
how it. I don't know how you managed to have no one know, because when I make
I never
a
talked
film,
about it until now, and so I'm really an idiot.
But we always, I mean, it's not only the $5 million that's spent on the actual insurance premiums. I mean, I can't imagine how much my company spends on the labor, because we always produce these massive binders where we go through every film and anything that could be mildly contentious, from someone has some kind of a logo on their clothing, music is coming from somewhere, there's an advertisement over there. The last one, the most frankly ridiculous one, that was flagged by our own lawyer was, I made a film for History and it had a photograph in it, and in the photograph, a soldier at the end of the Second World War was looking at the booty that the Nazis had collected, and the guy was looking at a painting, like a medieval painting, and our lawyer wanted us to clear the painting, not the photo, the painting. So we never get, you know, I've never been able to actually get anything contentious to a broadcaster, because it always stops at the lawyer. But I want to, before we go to Howard and get into more of the details of the paper, I'd like to ask Dan, you know, you guys, I'm going to make you responsible for all the sins of all broadcasters. you have to advise your company on how to not end up in trouble and presumably not have to go to litigation. I would assume that most people here are independent filmmakers or somehow involved in independent work. From your point of view, when you're dealing with an independence, what's the big concern? What are you trying to protect yourself from, primarily?
Well, I think it's fairly obvious to all of you that when we are buying one of your productions and putting it on the air, we are running a potential legal risk. So the issue for us is, how do we deal with that risk? How do we contain it? I wear two hats, essentially, when it comes to content. One is sitting here defending our requirement for E&O, and another is the hat I wear dealing with our journalists across the country who are producing in-house documentaries and in-house news production. And the practices that you are subjected to in the private sector are dramatically different from what we subject our journalists to inside CBC. So, for example, today, before it's getting up on this podium, I was asked by Hot Docs to sign a release form. And it goes through all kinds of lovely things this isn't the form, but it might as well be. All kinds of lovely rights I was supposed to sign away. Well, I know that I'm sitting here. I know there's a camera there. I know that it's going to be podcast. I have waived effectively the rights that I would be waiving had I signed this piece of paper. And this piece of paper won't absolve Hot Docs if I want to go after Hot Docs for some terrible misuse that they make of it. So the piece of paper is a panacea that is relied on in the private sector, is not relied on by us. When we send our crews out into the field, we don't get these pieces of paper. We don't ask our people to get pieces of paper. They get in the way of filmmaking. They get in the way of the projects we do. I hear about logos in the back of shots that are incidental. We put logos on routinely in in-house productions, and we've been able to convince some insurers to allow us to use logos in private productions because of our history of having used this and the lack of recourse that there has been by companies against us. So why are there these two standards? Well, we, yes, want to have some assurance that the product that you deliver to us is going to pass muster. Inside CBC, I give seminars to journalists on what they can and can't do. I explain to them what the law is, and they understand what they can and can't do. And if they have a question, they call me. In the private sector, you deliver us a product. I don't know where you got it from. I don't know whose idea it was. I don't know whether you stole any material from it, conceivably, or whether somebody's going to say you stole some material to get it in there. So there are needs for some due diligence. The question is, what are those needs and what is the due diligence? So we say, it's a simple matter, please get E&O. And that's the basic rule. And what we hope will happen, what we have hoped historically would happen, is that you would get an insurance company and you would get a lawyer to give you proper advice. In my experience, sadly, people go to different insurance companies and different lawyers and get different treatment that is not always, in my estimation, justified on the law. And as a result, you get what Kerwin talked about, which is very conservative opinions. Why? Sometimes because lawyers aren't familiar with the issues because they aren't battle-hardened. They don't deal with it on a daily basis. They read that there is a case somewhere that stands for a certain proposition, that you could be running a particular risk, and they say, well, okay, you want to avoid that risk at all costs. Well, maybe you don't want to at all costs. Maybe there are other ways to deal with that risk. I found that there are two kinds of lawyers in my experience dealing with filmmakers. One is the kind of lawyer who is alive to all the potential concerns and is constantly saying, no, 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 you can't do this. There's another kind of lawyer who recognizes that there are pitfalls, but finds ways for you to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. And one of the obligations, I think, one of the things you must have do as a producer is find a good lawyer who has a practical understanding of the law and who can give you the advice that you want. And you also can shop for insurance companies, because not every insurance company is the same. If you're dealing with an insurance company that is based in Hollywood and looks at the world from a Hollywood perspective, you're going to get different insurance demands than if you're dealing with, for example, an insurance company that deals with newspapers, that is used to occasional claims that are made in the regular course of business. So, yes, there are these different practices, but the practices don't have to be that divergent. Steamboat Willie brings up a case that I remember from when I first began at CBC. We did a program on the Fifth Estate, I believe, called The Cruel Camera, where we were talking about the use and misuse of animals on film sets, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, that kind of thing. And we used vast quantities of footage because we had to make the point. Did we go to them and ask for permission? No. Do we go to Disney routinely and ask them for permission? No, if we are relying on fair dealing or fair use. Why? Because the law permits you to use somebody else's material in circumstances when they wouldn't give you that permission themselves because they want to stop you from talking about it. So the basic law is if you're doing a book review, and you want to quote from a book, you don't need to ask the permission of the author to quote from the book. It's the same in film, same with Steamboat Willie, it's the same with Disney. And the fact that they have a department that is supposedly litigious shouldn't necessarily scare you, because as a practical matter, in Canada, in my 30 years here, we've never been sued by Disney.
Never?
Never.
Well, that's stunning because, you know, every private lawyer will tell you, of all of them, the ones you don't want to take on are Disney because they're the most litigious and da-da-da-da.
They have a legal department. But they also know that there is something called fair use in the United States, fair dealing in Canada. And if you are given proper advice and you know what fair dealing is in Canada, and the Supreme Court of Canada has just given us a wonderful decision on expanding the concept of fair dealing and saying that users have rights, if you know how to use that law, then you don't have to sweat the bullets that you sweat, and you can get your programs on the air. So that's the reason we have it, but the onus is on you to make sure the process works for you and you get the right advice, the right insurance company, and get your product on the air. And if you have difficulty, and CBC is commissioning your product, for example, come to the person at CBC and say, I'm having difficulty, how do I get over this hurdle? Because we can work with you and work with the insurer and work with the lawyer for the insurer to explain to them why we don't think it's a risk and why you should be able to get your product on the air.
Wow. So as we all know, you're a broadcaster like any, unlike any other. But before we start beating up on Steve and the insurance companies, Howard wrote a wonderful white paper, as Kerwin's mentioned, for Doc, which went through in detail a lot of the things that Daniel's just been talking about. And I highly recommend you go and take a look at it because it's really mind-blowing if you're like me and you've just only ever listened to your own lawyer. To actually go and have a much better sense of what precedent and law is really eye-opening. Howard, maybe you could go through, I know there's a number of recommendations that you made, and maybe if you went through those recommendations, they would help to clarify the situation as it is now. And I must remind you not to forget to tell people where they can access it, because is it on your website as well as Doc's?
It's on the Doc's website, docorg.ca, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's also on my firm's website. It was a real pleasure to do this paper, to work with Kerwin and his colleagues, and with on a really important project. I mean, I've been a copyright lawyer for a long time now, more than 25 years, and actually one of the first people I met in this business was Danny. Despite his youthful appearance, he's been around for a long time and really knows what he's talking about. And I looked up to him then, and I still do now, and his very enlightened point of view. But it saddened me over the years, and I do almost nothing but copyright law, and I did it in government and elsewhere, that the noose is tightening. I mean, copyright law, as others have said this morning, is causing more problems than it's helping the world of creativity. I mean, you folks want to create, you want to narrate the truth, and copyright is getting in your way. It's not there, it doesn't seem to be there to help you. And it's been suggested that you need to get the right insurance company and some good legal advice, some good practical legal advice. In fact, the situation is not as bleak as the clearance culture would suggest. The law as it is not that bad right now. It can certainly be improved, and I hope we can do that. And it must be improved in certain ways. What we need as much now is education as new legislation, because there's a lot of misunderstanding of what can actually be done right now. We can do quite a lot. In some ways, our system is actually more tolerant and easier for you than the American system. And I thought I would go through the recommendations that I had made in this paper. We tried to get some slides up this morning, but due to incompatibility of various versions of Microsoft with itself, I can't do that. I had about a dozen recommendations. Let me just go through them and comment on them, and I think in the course of doing so, we'll get a better idea of what the current law is and maybe where it ought to go. It's been mentioned that there's a significant difference between documentary films and fictional films. And there's a sort of middle ground area, which I'm learning more about, and some of you can perhaps enlighten me, called narrative films, which are sort of based on truth, but take liberties and don't purport to be absolutely accurate documentaries. And they're easier to do in some ways, but harder in others. from a legal standpoint. But let's consider at the moment the two traditional extremes of documentary and fictional film. And we need a good definition of a documentary film, and I suggested something along the lines of any cinematographic work or sound recording, because some documentaries are radio documentaries, for example, the purpose of which is to convey factual information and analysis relating to actual events or issues. There are some existing provisions that help the news industry and allow for sort of spontaneous news gathering and make life a bit easier for them in terms of fair dealing exceptions. Those don't necessarily apply to documentarians because a news is something that goes on 6 o'clock news. It's under a deadline. There isn't a lot of time to edit it or think about it. It's got to go out, and the system sort of tolerates liberties there that are not so easily tolerated in documentaries where you've got weeks or months or years to put the thing together. Those should probably merge closer together. For example, the requirement that attribution and credits be given under this proviso is probably unrealistic the way it now sits. Something that concerns me a lot as somebody spends a lot of time reading cases and writing about them is that in Canada right now, the courts have shot down the possibility of doing satire or parody because of copyright law. There's a very well-known case in legal circles, you may have heard about it, Michelin case, where a union out in Nova Scotia was picketing a Michelin plant, and they had some posters or boards or whatever made up with a picture of the Michelin man. Instead of holding an cute little baby, he was stomping on poor little union workers. And the Michelin people didn't think it was particularly funny and sued. And they won because the judge said, well, he copied the Michelin man. And forget about satire parody defense, forget about freedom of expression expense defense. This is Canada, you lose. And even though some people think maybe the decision is not right, it's on the books and there hasn't been anything to undo it since then. The American Supreme Court, on the other hand, has said that satire and parody are a broad, particularly parody is a very broad defense to copyright infringement, a very famous case about 10 years ago involving the Pretty Woman song, where a rap singer came out with a very dirty version of the lyrics, which I won't repeat, but they're very funny, and basically copied the music and turned the lyrics inside out, and won in the Supreme Court. We don't have that defense in Canada, we don't have a sense of humor in Canada, and it's seriously getting in the way of making good films. And there's no excuse in the world for that not being changed. I'm told that a certain musical rights organization about a block away from here, let me put it this way, near the corner of Wellesley and Bay, very near the corner, is standing in the way of a satire and parody exception. And that's particularly ironic because the major stakeholders of that organization, of course, have to deal with it in the United States. Another little problem we have in the case law in Canada is that it's difficult to include published interview material that's been published somewhere else. There was a case involving Shania Twain where one publishing company lifted material from another publishing company that was an interview. And the defense was, well, it's not protected by copyright, it's just an interview. Court didn't buy that, and that should probably be dealt with. By the way, on fair dealing, just a conceptual point that is important, and I'm not correcting Kerwin so much as just trying to clarify something that even a lot of lawyers don't understand. If what you are copying is truly insubstantial, the Copyright Act says that you need permission to copy a work or a substantial portion thereof. If what you are copying is not substantial, you don't need anybody's permission, period. You don't even have to worry about it. Now, what does that translate into in reality? Well, nobody's going to give you a percentage and say that 1% is substantial or 10% is not substantial or whatever. It depends on the context. If you copy, 6 lines of a sonnet, that's pretty substantial because the sonnet's only 14 lines. But if you copy 6 lines of a 1,000-page book, chances are that's not substantial at all. Now, the Copyright Board of Canada, bless their heart, tried to shed some light on this in a case last year, a company called Breakthrough Films. Anybody here know Breakthrough Films?
Yeah.
Okay. Are they here? Oh, okay. Well, anyway, the Copyright Board, the Breakthrough wanted to use 325 lines, if I remember the facts correctly, out of a 300-some-odd page book that had been published by some vanity press from some World War II veteran long since, with a, I can't remember his name, it's in my paper, very common name, is either dead or unfindable because his name is very common. Couldn't find the guy. 325 lines spread out in several episodes of a series from a 300-odd page book, and they were narrated. The Copyright Board has a process where they can give a license for unlocatable copyright owners. Most of the time it's a useful and fairly inexpensive and simple process. But this time, for the only time in history, all 5 members of the Copyright Board got involved in this decision at once, usually only 3 of them. All 5 got involved, and they split 3-2 as to whether or not it was substantial. They decided it was substantial. Then they split in a different 3-2 split as to whether or not you could retroactively ask for the license. And the whole thing, frankly, leaves everybody even more confused than they were before. And Copyright Board decisions are not binding jurisprudence in any event. So just remember, even before you think about fair dealing or fair use in the United States, there may be a possibility that, that a lawyer who understands these things can tell you, look, it's just not substantial and you just don't have to worry about it because it's so short. But it's not clear. The United States courts are all over the shop on this issue. You've got one court saying that even a millisecond or something of a sample in rap music will get you in trouble and it's infringing. Where you've got another court, frankly a somewhat more respected court, but they're conflicting with each other, saying that several seconds of a sample are not infringing. In fact, I don't remember, it was a good long chunk, basically because it wasn't very original and it wasn't the whole of the song. So you've got courts there diametrically conflicting in the United States on what substantiality is. Now, Dan mentioned the terrific Supreme Court case we have in Canada, Law Society of Upper Canada case from 2004 that says users have rights and they're just as important as owners' rights. That case involved lawyers copying stuff for their clients, because we have to do that for research purposes and to give to the court and stuff like that. The court said you can, notwithstanding the previous wisdom, you in some cases copy the whole of the work, and it doesn't matter that you're making money out of it. I'm saying lawyers hope to make money. That's why we went into law school, apart from saving the world, of course. And so you can make money at what you're doing, some documentarians even make money occasionally. The big guy in the United States. You know. But
we know of one.
Pardon?
We know of one know amongst of one. Us.
Yeah. We have now, and don't tell anybody this. We are verging on. This is sort of just between us, a system where by the Supreme Court is opening up the possibility of Canada having the best of both possible worlds. We have the certainty of the Canadian fair dealing system, which lists a bunch of exceptions, a bunch of specific things you can do, most of which are absolutely silly, like saying it's okay to write in chalk on a dry black erase board and then you can erase it afterwards with a dry eraser, but heaven forbid that you use a wet sponge because then you'll get sued. It really says that, actually. We have a whole bunch of stupid little
this
exceptions.
This is how lawyers have fun.
We have we have those little exceptions, but we also have this possibility of great big sort of American broad principle exceptions like the Supreme Court of Canada has given us, and which I can tell you some people, particularly from Quebec, are trying very hard to undo. Okay. So in your lobbying, you really want to fight to keep that decision alive and keep the spirit growing, because there are those who are working against it, maybe even some of those people over near Bay Street. We do have a terrific provision in the Canadian Act, which the Americans I've talked to are insanely jealous of, called the Incidental Inclusion Section, which says that if you are incidentally and not deliberately, here's where the complication comes, including a work in a context of another work, you don't have to get permission. So your logo on Yonge Street situation may well fall if push comes to shove in that incidental inclusion section. But the question is, what does not deliberately mean? I mean, for example, in news reporting, you know, if there's a car accident or murder or something on Yonge Street, I mean, nobody goes out to deliberately set that situation up. You can decide whether or not you're going to film it, but after that, you just basically take it as it comes. In a fictional film, you have, of course, lots of control and lots of time to think about these things. In documentary situation, you know, this has not been tested so far. I mean, Kevin and I worked on something that was published by the National Film Board a while back. I believe the example was you're doing a documentary about a young prostitute walking down Yonge Street and talking about her life and stuff like that, and you're just following her and shooting her, and she stops in front of a McDonald's and rants and raves and that sort of thing. And you know, you didn't tell her to stop in front of McDonald's, hopefully. But there she is, standing in front of McDonald's. Now, I would like to think that that's an incidental use of the McDonald's logo. Not that it matters anyway, but for other reasons which I will get to, that you can use the McDonald's logo probably. But one has to be aware of the argument that one could say it's deliberate, because I mean, if you had any control over the young lady and were able to say, well, you don't have to stop here, stop there, where there's nothing in the background, maybe somebody would say it is deliberate. Now, and by the way, I forgot to give my usual disclaimer, nothing I say here today is legal advice. Okay? Forget everything I'm going to say here today, because it's not specific to you, and you're not my clients, and I don't want to hear from you that somebody caused trouble for me. I just want to hear from you that you agree with me. Anyway, but so before I forget, that comes to another conceptual problem that a lot of people, including a lot of lawyers, have. If you happen to be shooting a film and in the background there's a McDonald's sign, logo, you are not using that trademark in the technical sense of using the trademark. I would be using a McDonald's trademark if I went out and got some coffee cups made with McDonald's on it, because people would then think I'm selling McDonald's coffee. But if I just happen to be doing a film and there's a McDonald's in the background, I'm not selling any food products. I'm selling a film. So I'm not using the trademark in any trademark sense. And is there copyright use involved, given that there's probably copyright in the McDonald's artwork? For a number of reasons, I think that in the kind of situations we've been talking about, there would be any number of defenses. So a lot of lawyers are very nervous about this kind of thing, and in my opinion, overly so, and I'm glad to hear that more enlightened broadcasters at least also see it that way. We also have a nice little exception in there that says it's okay to shoot a public building or a sculpture. You don't need anybody's permission for that. Clearing photographs can be a problem, and we need to retain certain provisions in there that now that the photographers are trying to get rid of to make sure it's relatively easy to clear photographs. Unlocatable copyright owners, quite apart from the confusion at the Copyright Board over the substance of the law, I think we need a much easier procedure, which is being talked about in the United States, that would basically say you don't have to go to the Copyright Board or anything, as long as you can prove that you exercise due diligence to try and find the copyright owner, they basically cannot sue you. Something to watch for in the forthcoming copyright legislation is that the American music industry in particular, and the American government as a whole, are trying to get really tough digital rights management and technical protection measures in place that will make it illegal for you to, for example, try and excerpt a few seconds off a DVD that you buy in the store, because you might want to include. Now, if there's a lock, if there's some kind of a technical protection measure on those, and there invariably is, under this legislation, if you try and get around it, or use a program to try and get around that and say, I just want these 2 or 3 seconds and I don't want to have to go to some complicated way of filming it off a screen or something like that, and losing quality, that could cause you a problem. It could cause you very big problems, and there are a lot of people going to fight against this, and I hope that Doc will be one of them. But it's going to be a difficult fight, I can tell you, because it's got the weight of the U.S. government and the so-called spokesman for the Canadian music industry behind it. They're really representing American interests. I'm suggesting in the paper that the government, perhaps the Department of Canadian Heritage, explore ways and get some funding to help this educational process work with insurers, work with lawyers, work with producers, directors, whatever, so to make sure that people do understand what's going on and maybe develop some sort of Canadian version of the best practices. You know, Peter Yazzie and Pat Ofterhout is a document which has worked out well in the United States. We probably need in the Copyright Act some kind of a provision that would explicitly allow for the penalization or sanction of companies that overly abuse copyright and assert copyright where they have no basis to. Even some very conservative judges in the United States, the very famous Judge Posner, is on to this issue about the dangers of overly abusive assertion of copyright law. Although, frankly, there's almost as much of a problem with overly nervous Nellies who are practicing copyright law and are afraid of their own shadow and tell you you can't do this and you can't do that. They're not being abused, they're just being too nervous. There's a problem with archival footage because archives want money, mostly because they need money, and they're also getting some bad advice. But maybe more funding for archives from the government would help that. I talked about the need to understand more about trademarks and how trademarks law doesn't enter the picture, even though many people think it does. So, you know, the problem about this clearance culture is that, you know, there are a lot of lawyers telling you what you can't do and a lot of insurance companies telling you what you can't do. And it seems to me that, obviously, from our side of the fence in this room, we want to figure out what can be done, creative ways of doing it. It's been indicated that there actually is remarkably little, I mean, zero is pretty categorical, actual litigation going on here. So maybe everybody is overly worried. Maybe we need more competition in the insurance business, and we need more creativity, not only in filmmaking, but in getting through these problems. I mean, if you go to a lawyer and say, can I do this or can I do that, and he or she says, well, you might get sued, you might get sued, you might get sued, well, you may decide not to listen to your lawyer. I mean, your lawyer should also tell you that if you go out to film a documentary that there's, you know, whatever percent statistical chance that you'll be struck by lightning while you're filming that documentary. And if you really want to make sure you don't get struck by lightning, stay at home and don't film the documentary. You know, there are all kinds of risks in life. And it sounds like the risk of getting sued is actually quite low. Therefore, you know, we should move away from the clearance culture and towards a more expansive notion of what can be done. So that was the gist of my paper, and I think you'll have no trouble finding it, and hopefully it'll be useful and provoke some further discussion. Thanks.
The problem for us, of course, is that we don't get to choose risk, and in fact, you gentlemen, two of the best copyright lawyers in the country, have just said, Dan said, yeah, you can quote from film, blah, blah, blah. And you said, well, the case law is, you know, you can't, you know, maybe you can't, maybe you'll lose. So with that, I turned to Steve, and, you know, Howard just said, work with the insurers. Now, I've never worked with an insurer. I've never gotten past my own lawyer and having to have every, you know, T crossed and I dotted before, and then it was sent off to insurance. So I don't, maybe this is just a big lawyer scam. But from your point of view, you had, when we were talking earlier, said, yeah, it is possible to open up a dialogue with the insurance company. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure, I can. First off, I think it's important to just distinguish two different players on the insurance side. There's a broker, which is what I am. So I work with a producer client. I'm the one that's going to try and communicate with the underwriters at the insurance company. A bit about your project, tell them what it's all about. We're probably involved in the production insurance as well as the E&O component. So we get to learn and understand the project, and we communicate that with the insurance company. The insurance company is the one that actually takes the risk. So when things go wrong, and if there is a claim brought against the producer, it's the insurance company that's going to be funding and dealing with the defense. So it's important to make that distinction. And I think that the process as it goes can go a couple of different ways. I encourage clients, producers, to look at it like a collaboration. Most people wouldn't think of collaborating with an insurance company when it comes to making a good film, but I will tell you that it can be a very effective process. It can be one that, if started early and started in a very open dialogue fashion, can actually work to your advantage. I think that it's very, very important, and Howard's touched on this, everybody's touched on this, there are areas that you can go into that you don't have to fear. There are the fair dealings issues. There are the ability to use some of these elements in your film without fear. You are getting advice from your lawyer, and obviously they're going to be perhaps looking on a more conservative, taking a more conservative approach than what you would like them to. But that's why I say that when you look at the process happening between an insurance company's lawyer and your lawyer, maybe it is important to interject yourself into that process, bring your broker into the process so that they're able to advocate what you're trying to achieve and raising some of these issues to challenge it, because we don't necessarily have to take everything that is told to us at face value. We can, and the more educated you are as a producer of a film, the more you can ask good questions, the more you can be part of this process. And we've had many, many situations where insurers and their lawyers are looking at a film that a client of ours is producing, and their lawyer, the underwriter's lawyer, may be saying, no, I don't think, you shouldn't do this. It's, here's what the law says. And we're able to convince the underwriter to take a different position, to say, no, we recognize there's a risk, but we're prepared to take it.
And why would they ever do happen. That? Why would they ever do that?
Well, I think it's all about how, they're there to support, and interestingly enough, there's only a handful of insurers. Some of them do actually, though, really, they find themselves as a part of this industry. They feel an obligation to try and not suppress the creation of this. They actually do try to support it, and they do want to see good films made. So that's typically why they'll do it. If they know something is going to be squashed, simply because something can't be used, they will. Some of them will go out on a limb, but it's all about how you communicate it to them. And I think we're very effective communicators. I think that you're very effective communicators. And we have a number of situations where early on in the process, when the idea is just conceived, that we take our client, we'll take a producer, we'll take their lawyer, we'll sit in the room with the underwriter, the insurance company, and their lawyer, and we'll start going through this process. And we do this with a fair regular basis, because not everything, it's a far better time to do it than once the film is finished and we're a week away from delivery or broadcast, because that's panic time, and nobody has an insurer, I will tell you, that if pushed to the edge in terms of time, they will go to the conservative side. They won't take the risk. Allow them their process, allow them to go through it. You might be surprised with what you can actually accomplish.
I have lots of questions, I'm sure other people do as well. Since we only have about a half an hour left, I'd like to open the floor up to questions, and I just want to ask you to wait for a second until you have a microphone, because this thing is being podcast, so we want to make sure that we can clearly hear you. This person here?
Can they identify who's asking?
Yeah, that would be helpful. If you could say your name before you ask your question, please.
My name is Michael Cullen, and I'm an entrepreneur filmmaker. So I have two questions, one for Dan and one for the rest of the panel, perhaps. Dan, you made a comment earlier about having to sign a release form and then saying, well, even if you signed it, you could override it. As a filmmaker, obviously, that's a concern in terms of getting release forms from people that we're working with. My second question is, in terms of getting sued or the potential for that, from my entrepreneurial background, I'm under the impression that you could set up a corporation, do a movie perhaps, and then collapse that corporation. So that legal entity is the one that's still bearing the rights to that project. But as a filmmaker, I could be disassociated from that. Is that a possibility, or is that what realm are we talking about there?
So let's take them one at a time. And I too was shocked because I've spent so much bloody time on those annoying pieces of paper. Are they a waste? Well, do we not need them?
What a release is in my understanding, is a means that you have to dissuade the person that you're getting the release from to go after you, because they have a hurdle to overcome. But these are not ironclad agreements. They're not negotiated. They're dumped on the person. They're using language that they often don't understand. They can be undermined by evidence of the nature of the conversation that you had that led up to the signing of the document. So it really has very limited value. I mean, what you, if as a matter of practice, it's easy for you to get and you want to get it and you want to dissuade people from coming after you, then I wouldn't discourage you from doing it. But if it's going to interfere in the filmmaking process, and you're not taking anybody's copywritten ideas, which they're expressing in a certain form, which could pose real copyright problems, if it's just an ordinary interview, then I wouldn't worry a lot, provided your understanding is in the right place. I mean, in reality, the person whose interview you're getting doesn't know what you're going to do with it. So you could put that person, you could clip them, put them in a film, defame them.
Borat them.
And there will be Borat litigation, which may shed light on this, from what I understand. So don't put too much stock in it. And if you are working with an enlightened insurance company and an enlightened lawyer, and it is a problem for you, there are ways to get around it.
There's a filmmaker in Boston whose name I can't remember, the Alzheimer's setting in. And he famously doesn't give out releases. But he asks people on camera, is it okay if I interview you? And if they say no, he stops the process. If they say yes, that's it, he goes ahead.
Well, it's the first thing our lawyers, they spend. I guess I'm starting to feel this is just all about really paying lawyers. Because it's the first thing our lawyer does is go through all those release forms. And if you don't have a release form, they don't want that interview in. So this is very helpful.
You have to change lawyers? Is that what you're saying?
That's quite absolutely clear. Now, to the second question, I think the gentleman's asking, can I set up a company and then to do what I want and then collapse the company? Is that some kind? Was that your question? Is that a protection? I had this conversation with someone last night. If I set up a company, I make my film, I have a problem of some sort, I get sued, whatever, can I just let that company die or be destroyed, and all my other companies and works will be safe? It's a different area of law, I know, but anyone have an opinion on that?
One of the sacred cows in the canon of law that's starting to crumble is the notion that you cannot pierce the corporate veil. I mean, at one time, companies used to be set up and collapsed with great regularity for exactly this purpose, but there is an increasing tendency, it doesn't happen all the time, but it happens more often than one would think, of the courts saying, we don't care what paperwork you're throwing around. This film was made by so-and-so, and he's the person, he's the guiding mind behind it, and we're going to go after him. And now it's very common in lawsuits not only to sue a company, but to sue the president and the directors and whatever, just to put pressure on them. So gradually that edifice is crumbling. So it's not a foolproof way of avoiding liability. If life were that simple, life would be that simple. And as far as releases go, I mean, somebody said earlier, I mean, you got to be practical about it. I mean, if you're filming, I don't know, something on motorcycle gangs, and you happen to run across Hell's Angels and Satan's Choice having a great grand row on Yonge Street or something, I don't think you're going to go up to these people and ask them to sign a release. So, I mean, you gotta be practical about it. And it's not necessary in all circumstances, clearly.
Okay, over here.
My name is Rick Kane, and we have a film here called Manufacturing Dissent that looks at Michael Moore. When we went to our insurance broker, we were told there were 8 or 9 companies who potentially would give us E&O. 7 of them bailed without even looking at the actual film that we produced. And the other 2 that are potential insurers were on sort of the highest rate scale known to man. I'm wondering why, for instance, in the automobile industry, I think this is our 6th or 7th film we produce, we've never been sued by anyone. Why aren't we getting some sort of senior citizens discount like we get in the auto industry for drivers, whereas in the insurance industry, it seems to be just the opposite. If you make contentious films, forget it. You're going to have to deal with Lloyd's of London or one of these people.
Right. Well, I think it's a good point, but I think, now I wasn't involved in the insurance on your film, so I don't know any of the facts around it. What's up? I think the difference, though, just drawing the parallel between auto insurance and this type of insurance probably isn't a great parallel, and I'll tell you why I think that. Each film is so dramatically different from one to the next and can bring a whole different myriad of exposures to the producer, to the insurer that might be underwriting it. And so therefore, I don't think the fact that you've had, you know, great success at producing good films and never been sued doesn't mean that this one won't be the one. So I think that's my comment there. But I do think that you need to communicate to any underwriter is that you have made all those films, that you do actually have a handle on how to do this and have really good legal representation so they can also communicate that. We do run into challenging projects, there's no question. I don't think we've ever had a film yet that we haven't been able to find coverage on. But the fact is, it's about how it's communicated, it's about what the film is all about. Are there issues? Are there true legal issues there that you just can't get around?
I would suggest you also talk to Pat Ofterhide and Peter Jazzy in Washington, if you already haven't done that. Look at the best practices pamphlet they've written and talk to them, because they're in contact with insurers who are changing their policies based on that.
Well, talk
to them specifically, if you haven't, talk to them specifically, because they are in contact with all kinds of insurers.
So the other element is always balancing premium cost as well. And, you know, there is an insurer that will take on most risk. They're out there. You can negotiate terms. The second part of that discussion is always, is it affordable and is it realistic? And, you know, are you asking them to take on a risk that you may not be prepared to take on yourself? And I think you always have to remain very objective when it comes to this stuff, too.
You know, I'm thinking of a question that one of the things they always teach you as lawyers, never ask a question if you don't know the answer already. But this question is burning at me, and I'll ask it of Dan. Why doesn't the CBC or other major broadcasters who, and I know you partly answered this earlier by saying that you expect independents to come to you and have done their homework and hand you a product that you can feel reasonably safe about and an insurance certificate. But couldn't you use your mighty power and your prestige to go to insurance companies and get them to compete with each other and offer you some kind of a blanket policy that would cover everything you broadcast as long as you do some reasonable due diligence inside and have, you know, trained staff, 2 or 3 people to just vet stuff as it comes in and say, well, this looks like it's been professionally done and we're prepared to rely on the integrity of the people who did it and not require sort of all of this excess caution and enormous amounts of insurance money to be paid. And so essentially the CBC, being taxpayers funded and whatever, assumes a good chunk of the risk and negotiates a really good deal with a big insurance company.
Well, that's an option that we've looked at. It's There are a number of elements to that. First of all, the projects that the private sector producers are producing involve equity positions that we don't have, and they are wanting to rightly market their films around the world, something we don't benefit from. We're interested in getting a project on in Canada generally for our market. So insurance for ourselves is something we can consider, using our own lawyers, something we can consider. There's a cost built into that as well. I think what we have done is defer effectively to the idea that the private producers will want to market their films, will want their own insurance. I know that Doc is looking at getting a blanket policy for producers in Canada. That might be an answer as well. I think we'd be open to any mechanism that would provide us with the assurance we need, the due diligence we need, and the product that we want. But we're obviously not there yet, and this is where we've arrived.
Better still if you and the three or four major networks in the United States got together and did this kind of thing, it might promote the kind of maturity in the insurance business and more risk willingness in the insurance business.
Well, yeah, I think though as well. I mean, broadcasters do insure themselves. I don't know the situation with the CBC.
We're self-insured.
You're self-insured. But, they do carry insurance for this, but there's a contract there under your license agreement that says you will indemnify the broadcaster for any claims that are brought against them. That's what you're funding, is you're funding that indemnity. Because without the insurance policy, the indemnity isn't all that worthwhile because there's no money behind it necessarily. So broadcasters do insure themselves, and maybe the way to go is to say, hey, as a broadcaster, if you have something that does have some contentious issues to it and the producer is running into problems insuring it, then maybe as the broadcaster you could come to the table and put up the ability to put up the funds or the ability to be able to take on some of that risk.
I have a file folder in my filing cabinet of jokes that didn't make it to air insured.
Yeah.
And they're very funny, and we eventually decided that we would let them go to air because we would assume the risk.
Yeah.
So there are ways of getting around it.
There are in-house jokes and then there are out-house jokes.
Nice, Kerwin. I think there's there's a lady here. I'd like to ask a question.
Yes, hello. My name is Diana Stelvakari, and I'm here as president of the International Documentary Association. And we were one of the authoring organization who supported the statement of fair use practice in the United States. And we brought copies, by the way, and this is Pat's work. There's some on the table downstairs. We are a 25-year-old organization who basically supports documentary filmmaker, and this work came out of the frustration from the documentary side. And I'm not quite clear yet on the difference between our vocabulary saying fair use, and I think you call it here fair dealing. Is it the same? Is it not the same? That's my first question. Also, we just had a major breakthrough last month, which was just announced, about a insurance company in the United States who now is offering fair use insurance. And there's a whole article in our latest magazine about fair use. And they are covering exactly what you did in your film and have put together a list of lawyers that have been approved by them who will look at your film and decide if you can fall under. And it's quite affordable. And again, this is all coming from the fact that, we don't have the system in place that you have here in Canada, which means that you're largely supported by your government and broadcaster. We're coming at it from a real independent point of view. So if you could give me a little bit of a clarification on fair dealing versus fair use, I'd really appreciate.
The United States has the fair use system. The statute basically outlines four factors. Does it compete with the interests of the copyright owner or whatever? It doesn't give you a lot of specific guidance. It gives you very little, as a matter of fact. So the law in the United States has developed in the courts. And being a litigious country, people are okay with that. And so you have to look at case law, and copyright lawyers are supposed to know their case law and say, oh, there's a case like this or like that or whatever. There's the parody case, or there's the sampling case, and this suggests to me that the law will be that and such. The Canadian tradition comes from England. It's called fair dealing. It's not necessarily any different in the result. It's just a very different way of looking at it. It's like the glass, is the glass half empty or half full? The British system, which we have in Canada, as I say, has this long, I don't know, it's about 10 pages almost, of specific things that you can do under specific circumstances. And it gives you certainty if you can find something on the list that describes what you're doing. That's really the difference. Because the rationale being, we're not as litigious, we don't like to go to court, we believe our government is here to help us and the government will give us the answers to everything. But unfortunately it doesn't work that way. And as I say, we may be stumbling into the sort of best of both possible worlds, where we get the sort of openness and creativity and expansiveness that the Supreme Court of the United States and the Supreme Court of Canada are heading to. So we have that creative possibility in Canada, along with the list of specific exceptions. I mean, for example, we have this incidental use exception in Canada, which the Americans don't have, which is very helpful for filmmakers. The Americans don't have it. They might have it under case law, but there are a couple of well-known recent examples, which I mentioned in my paper, I'm sure are familiar to all of you. One was about, I'll tell you in a second. Amy Sewell, producer of Mad Hot Ballroom, about a documentary about U.S. children ballroom dancing, filming a kid who happens to get a call from his mother on a cell phone, and the ringtone was the Rocky ringtone, and apparently had to pay $10,000 to hear the phone ring. The other was somebody who's doing a documentary about Wagner's Ring Cycle, backstage at the Metropolitan, I guess, and the stagehands were sitting around relaxing, drinking coffee or beer, whatever they were drinking, and in the background was a TV set that happened to have The Simpsons on it at that time. Apparently they had to pay $10,000.
The producer of The Simpsons said it was okay, but yeah. Fox TV said it was not okay.
Yeah. Now, question whether they were getting good legal advice or not, I don't know, but the problem in this business is, and I've seen it happen many times when it shouldn't happen, is people just say, you know what, I'll pay the $5,000 or $10,000, even though it really irritates me and it's setting a very bad precedent, because it's cheaper than paying my lawyer and it's cheaper than protracting this, and I'll just get on with it. But the trouble is, every time that happens, it raises the costs higher for the next round for everybody.
The problem, there are a lot of problems here, but one is that I've looked at the budgets in Canada of documentary from 1984 to 2001, and if you talk constant dollars, in English Canada they've gone down by 41%, in French Canada they've gone down by 33%. Simultaneously, in terms of clearances, they've gone up. So the people who can't make any money in order to make a documentary, the people in the middle, the producers and directors, who are increasingly taking a vow of poverty, as we all know. So what Doc thinks in Canada is that the independent filmmakers have to stop being so independent that they get picked off one by one by organized broadcasters, insurers, and what have you, present company excluded, and say to them, okay, we're going to band together, we're going to work ensemble, and we're going to do things for our own interests in order to reduce the cost of E&O, reduce the cost of production insurance, and allow us to be able to make films on subjects that we want without having to pay an arm and a leg. And so I'm glad that IDA is here, and maybe we should get together someday.
Can I?
Okay. I
just wanted to add to that with the whole Rocky thing. Is part of that is knowing and understanding that in the beginning and not going and seeking out the rights to that music. If you know and you assess it in the beginning, because the problem is that I think as soon as you go, say, okay, we want to license this, sure, we'll license it to you, write us a check.
Right.
But if you know that you're using it and you're well within your rights to use it and you're protected somewhat by the law, then you make that decision without ever going there in the first place. And that's why I say about education, you don't have to operate just relying on everything you're told. So
don't ask and don't tell.
Don't let them know.
We'll call it the Steamboat Willie.
The Steamboat Willie defense. Okay, we're running short on time. There's a question here, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Claude Forest. I'm an insurance broker and a former documentary filmmaker. I started at the CBC about the same time as Dan did, and I've spent the last 20 years insuring film. I agree with everything that's been said, and agree with Steve, my colleague, about the ability to bring the insurance company's lawyers to the table. That's when you're dealing with insurance companies that use lawyers. That is, there are two types of insurance policies for documentary filmmakers specifically. One's called claims made, the other one's called occurrence. And both of them should be explored with your broker. But I'd like to turn the question more into the way that the system seems to be stacked against the filmmaker. Although you can negotiate the contract at the insurance point, and you can hopefully have a lawyer who's prepared to push the envelope and buy into the creative of the producer, there's also the broadcaster setting the levels of insurance that they require and the term of the insurance that they require early in the agreement, when the producer may not be educated, as Steve points out, the education being so important, that the producer's signing off on these conditions that they don't understand, and then later they have to meet them. So if you're asking for $1 million per occurrence and $3 million in the aggregate, which is kind of the standard, with a $10,000 deductible, then you find the producer, and especially in documentary, faced with unrealistic limits. First of all, $1 million per occurrence, especially with the statistics of 5 years of E&O experience among 170 filmmakers here with not a single claim, would say to me that $1 million would be ample, not only per occurrence, but in the aggregate. Yeah. And if you had a $1 million per $1 million aggregate, the rates would drop. The other thing is the term of insurance. We know that the likelihood of a claim is highest around the time of the broadcast. Well, it would seem to me that the broadcaster can play their part by saying, well, if in the first 3 years of the term there's no claim, then we'll let the insurance go on to our broadcaster's E&O, and in the case of the CBC, onto their self-insurance concept. Because there again, they'd be sharing in the risk, and the premiums would drop at least a couple of $1,000s. There are other strategies that can be employed and should be explored, but I think we need to put pressure right where the demands begin. The insurance company is very happy to sell what the broadcasters want, and the broadcasters won't accept certificates that don't have the standard terms and no non-standard exclusions.
And of course, you know, that comes back really to what Kerwin was saying about acting collectively, because as a filmmaker, you're dealing with a commissioning editor. They don't have the power to set any of this. So I don't know how at CBC that sort of policy is set in terms of what you're going to require. Is that something that comes from the legal department?
Well, it's a company policy that there is E&O, and the terms are there. I think that the idea of discussing this is not outside the realm of possibility. Usually it becomes clearer as time goes on whether or not there are adjustments necessary to the quantum of coverage or the deductible that's in the policy. And it all has there's a cost for everything, so the cost is built into the budget and we contribute to the budget. So there are ways to work this through, and what you're talking about is people signing agreements without proper advice from the outset, and as a lawyer standing back here, I would say everybody should have proper legal advice from the word go, and not sign contracts that they don't understand.
The problem actually is, though, I don't know how familiar you are with this process, but the budget is set, the film's financed,
right.
And then the contract thing starts. You know, it's very typical for us to have an agreement. We know we're going to make a film. I'm shooting a film right now. It was agreed to in September. The contracts aren't finished.
Oh, there's a short form.
There's a short form agreement.
Sure.
But does it actually set out the limits of the insurance?
I can't swear up and down that it does. I would imagine it does.
Okay.
I think. If I could just add to this as well, one of the things, and you make some really good points, is it's the term of the insurance. What we're finding is a lot of broadcasters are requiring the E&O to be enforced from beginning of principle, from the time you begin shooting your film. So if you have a 2-year production period and a 5-year license agreement, you're now talking about 7 years of E&O insurance, sometimes more. We're seeing these long, drawn-out policies where, yeah, that drives the cost up anywhere from $500 to $1,000 per additional year. So you start adding that on. And I think, again, that's a good point about putting pressure
on the broadcaster. Well, I think the point that Claude is making is that the risks are lower, so logically, from an insurance point of view, the cost of the insurance should reduce as the term goes on. But from a broadcaster's perspective, if we're buying 7 years or 6 years of a film, then that should be covered some way. It has to be addressed.
I agree. It's just you chew up a big chunk of time through the production period when theoretically your risk is very low from the standpoint of an E&O claim. You know, you're paying for 2 years of coverage that, or a year and a half, or depending on the production period, beginning of shooting to the time you deliver, you chew through a whole bunch and you're spending money every one of those years. So.
I want to get one more question. Howard, did you want to add something quickly?
Yeah, I appreciated Claude's comments a lot too, because I mean he was saying in a different and very constructive and specific way what I was getting at earlier, which is, you know, why can't the CBC and other major broadcasters look at this from the top down and maybe restructure the way things are done, and maybe, you know, if we can get the government to organize some sort of a systematic way of looking at this, that would be, I think, a new issue that should be put on the table. And at least at the CBC, it looks like there's an open mind to it. I mean, you know, because maybe there are ways of eliminating unnecessary costs and unnecessary belts and suspenders type insurance attitude. I mean, there's a 3-year limitation on suing for copyright infringement. You know, if they don't sue within 3 years, they can't, basically.
So what are you buying? The E&O for you?
But the E&O is just a copyright issue.
There are other short limitations.
Defamation claims start from the time.
I know, but
subject to it.
I know you have to look at each cause of action differently. There are different limitation barriers. I'm very, very aware of that. But it may be that there's a lot of extra insurance being paid for that isn't necessary.
Okay, I think we only have time for one more question. There's someone here has the microphone, so they get it.
Ken Hirsch, PMA Productions in Montreal. I just have a very quick question for Kerwin, as a very soon-to-be doc member. Do you think we could start to put together a list like our American colleagues for each province of lawyers and insurance companies who will act aggressively on our behalf and that we can feel comfortable going to with our E&O and clearance issues?
Sounds like a good idea. Sure. We can start with really aggressive lawyers, and then we can move down to the other kind.
Thank you all very much. I hope you'll join me in thanking our panelists. It's very interesting. Thank you.
Yep.